Hi, Pooja.
Hi, Anand. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good.
So today my guest is Pooja Dhiwan. She's the Vice President and Chief Data and Analytics Officer for Otis Elevator Company. In this critical role, she leads the company's data science and analytics capabilities, identifying opportunities to accelerate growth and efficiency. She owns the Otis Data Management Roadmap, driving sustainable business growth and profitability, as well as internal efficiencies through improved data structures, constant data cleanliness and insight, and efficient data governance and processes. Prior to this role, Pooja spent more than 20 years at BNSF Railway, where she served as the Chief Data Scientist. There she led the OR and Advanced Analytics Group for 16 years. Her team received international recognition through an Informs Award as the Best Advanced Analytics Team in 2019. Pooja has been a member of Informs since 1993. During this time, she led several initiatives offered by Informs, including the Edelman Competition, and she has also been instrumental in championing activities that help bridge the gap between academia and real-world application. Pooja, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anand, and looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. So I know you're obviously from India, but from which part, from which city?
So Anand, I grew up in India, as you mentioned. I grew up in Delhi, the capital city of India, before I came to the US.
Right. Tell me about your parents.
So my father was a banker, so he worked for the State Bank of India, and my mom was a teacher, and by the time she retired, she was actually the principal in a government school.
Nice. And any siblings?
Yes, I have a brother who's still living in Delhi.
Right. And which languages can you speak and understand as a person coming from India?
So Punjabi is actually my mother tongue, but surprisingly, I can understand Punjabi. I can speak Punjabi very rudimentary, but not very fluently. I speak Hindi fluently. I speak English because most of our education was in English. I can read and write Sanskrit. I don't do that anymore, but that's about it. There are several Indian languages that are very similar to Hindi. So if people are speaking in them, like Marathi, Gujarati, I can understand that, but I won't be able to talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's somewhat standard for someone that grew up in India. Yeah, I always find that very impressive.
Yes,
so you grew up during the 70s and 80s in Delhi, as you said. How was life back in the day?
So I think, you know, in the 70s and 80s, I can, from my end, say our life was truly exemplary. I mean, my parents, they both were working, had strong work ethics. They really valued education for both me and my husband. I mean, my brother, and we both went to a very elite private school in Delhi. So even coming from modest background, their emphasis was on education. And I know you and I have chatted in the past as well. I always loved studying and loved learning. So, you know, kind of they provided the best environment. So I can't complain. I mean, I probably have a lot to be thankful for in terms of having access to the resources or education that a lot of people in India won't. And especially the school, where it was not just focused on making us learn knowledge, but also be productive members, sort of kind of focus on a wholesome development. So giving back to society, understanding what privileges we have, and learning that, you know, education is just a means to become a better person and not just a means in itself.
Right. And you really made use of the opportunity that your parents provided, and that's nice and very obvious in your case. I once heard you saying that India is a bouquet with different colors. Can you elaborate more on this, please? I love this quote.
Well, I know, and I think it's because if you know, think about India itself, every state in India has a language of its own, has some customs of it, their own, food of their own. And I'm, by the way, a very big foodie as well. So living in India, you could almost go from one state to another state, and you were exposed to completely new dialects, new food, new customs. There was a very strong overlap between them, but yet a uniqueness that was brought about. So, you know, I kind of equate living in India, being exposed to that cosmopolitan environment, that, you know, kind of a fusion melting pot in itself. So it's a bouquet of flowers, colored flowers that you can feel. And you can see that actually a lot more now, because even when we were growing up, it was still beginning. We were starting to get exposed to different states. But now, if you go and visit India, it seems like every city is celebrating everything in any other part of the India as well. So I think a lot more blending happening right now than what I was exposed to 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more with that quote. I visited India only once during the 90s, and you know, I was in Chennai, Bangalore, and Delhi, and you know, Agra, of course. And I could see, you know, every time I go to a different state, then I'll face a different language, and you know, even though you're part of the same country, you can clearly see the differences, and that's very, very nice and inspiring in a way. Did you enjoy reading books back in the day?
Oh, I was an avid reader. So, you know, the range of books I read ranged from all sorts. So, you know, I read mystery novels, I'm not sure you're aware about, like Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. I read, you know, the classical English literature that we were all exposed to, Tale of Two Cities, all the Pride and Prejudice, all the Jane Austen, you know, novels you can think of. I read comics, you know, believe it or not. I had, they were the Indian flavor of comics too, which talked about a lot of the Indian mythology. And I actually learned a lot of mythology through those comic books in like Amar Chitra Katha, or, you know, comics around just like the Marvel heroes you have.
Right.
We have the heroes, the action heroes on the India side. So I read comics on that side. So. And other than that, you know, we were not living in a world of Google. So I love to learn. So I read a lot of books to just learn content beyond what was being taught in the class too. So it was a fun time, because that was a time where you really relied on books to kind of build an imagination around yourself. Oh, I forgot science fiction. I was a big Asimov fan, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. These kind of were influential books in our formative years to help us kind of see the world in a different way.
Yeah,
so books have always played an important role in my life.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that you self-taught calculus when you were in sixth grade?
That's right. So my brother, who was a few years older than me, was trying to learn calculus, and he was not that fond of math. And he was trying to learn it from others, from teachers, and he was failing. So I just said, okay, I'm going to take up your book and try to see what this is all about and why it's so difficult. So yes, I did that.
And
so by the time he started learning calculus in my grade and I reached at that, I was already using Shanti Narayan to start keep myself occupied.
That's incredible. I mean, that's a hell of an achievement. And did your teachers encourage you to study advanced topics?
Oh, absolutely. I think my school, as well as my the teachers itself, along with my parents, had a very strong influence in my formative years. So, you know, if I think back, if you think from India perspective about 35 plus years ago, there is still a lot of, you know, the gender parity issues you were dealing with. But in my school structure, I was never exposed to the fact that I was a girl versus a boy, and my learning abilities need to be limited, or what I should and should not do is kind of tied to my gender. And I think it's extremely, I can kind of tell that's because of my family and my teachers, because they just truly saw the joy I had in learning, and they would just encourage me in that. So I still remember my computer science teacher, because in those days we did not have access to computers, would give me extra lab classes and access to computer, so that, you know, I, because for me it was almost like fun. And coming from a middle class family, not having access to personal computers at that age, I think she would be instrumental in my love for computer science. I used to get, you know, read from Feynman series and have questions around things. And I still remember my physics and chemistry teachers giving up their lunch breaks to try to answer my questions, which were way beyond what we were discussing in class. So I think I was very fortunate to be able to attend a school that actually affirmed me and, you know, my learning desire, rather than kind of box me in on what the society had put on a lot of other younger women.
Yeah, that's truly amazing. And other schools from different parts across the globe should, you know, try to mimic or, you know, replicate this type of attitude, because it only encourages talents like you to thrive and, you know, to have a better future ahead, right? And did you practice any sports?
Oh, yes, I did that too. So I loved running. So I ran track for my school, and I was pretty good at it. And I did even a little bit of shot put and javelin.
Wow.
I played a little bit of field hockey, again, dabbled in all of it. I just used to love to play. And so I remember when I was growing up, in the evening, as soon as we reached home, I would just put my bag away and be out as long as there was daylight outside. I was playing with the kids outside. So we had, you know, games that we played, you know, badminton clubs, TT clubs, all created locally for all the kids to keep ourselves busy. And, you know, my parents always encouraged, you know, they never felt I could always keep up with the grades and beyond. So from their perspective, they never, ever felt that. As I started growing up in my high school, I started learning even Taekwondo, because the, you know, the perception of safety and learning self-defense was very important. So I, outside of school, used to, you know, learn Taekwondo and compete in Taekwondo as well. So yes, it's keeping, you know, running and keeping yourself fit is an important part of keeping my brain sharp.
Wow, that is, I would say, somewhat unexpected from a person that, you know, coming from India. Because if you see, they're mostly interested in cricket and those, maybe field hockey, but then you went all over the place, and that's just fantastic. One of your uncles was very influential in your life, right?
Yes. So my father's younger brother, He was, you know, he almost used to treat me as his own daughter. He was very influential in my life. He used to work in defense labs in India, and he had access to a lot of friends who were very educated, some of them studying abroad. So he would make sure, you know, if I had questions or I was curious, I had access to the people and resources to be able to ask questions. So you're absolutely right. I think, he's probably one of the reasons I'm here studying abroad.
Yeah. My dad has a similar story. He was very much influenced by his grandfather, you know, to think, to be more ambitious and to consider studying abroad and things like that. So I can relate to that. So which degree did you pick for your undergrad and why?
So I picked up industrial engineering for my undergraduate. So, you know, based on your grades, you have certain qualification criteria, so I could get into Delhi College of Engineering. And the uncle that I mentioned, one of his close friends' brother, was Dr. Kattamurthy from Michigan's Ann Arbor. So I had a chance of talking to Dr. Murthy when I was very young, and I always loved math and the way he described the kind of work he does on mathematical modeling to help solve problems, you know, real world problems sounded so fascinating. So I had my mind made up that when I enter into engineering school, I'm going to go for industrial engineering.
Nice. So how was your first experience with OR?
So we had two courses around OR in my undergraduate, more in my third and fourth year, that kind of introduced us to sort of the basics of operations research. So, you know, we were learning about simplex and linear programming, very high level queuing and inventory control at that time. So again, you know, really enjoyed those two classes. So they reaffirmed my, you know, feeling now I wanted to actually go towards more of a specialization in industrial engineering. So I said, okay, for my master's, I want to perhaps target operations research part of the industrial engineering itself.
I see. And what made you leave the country for higher studies?
So I knew I always wanted to do, you know, higher studies, and I had offers for my IIT, for my master's as well. But, you know, one, I had a desire to travel. Two, at that time, you know, the education, at least from graduate level, the cutting edge work that was happening abroad had still not caught up as much back in India. So felt that, you know, going abroad, giving myself exposure to learning in a different world, being able to, you know, stay on your own would help me learn a lot more than just education. Remember, I told you, life is a lot more than just what books teach you. So thought it was a perfect opportunity to come abroad and get my master's and PhD.
I see. You have a master's and a PhD from Penn State. But you actually joined another university first, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So when I went to the States, I went to University of Delaware for a year before I transferred to Penn State for my master's and PhD.
Is there any reason?
You know, I joined an OR program, but I wanted to be part of, you know, more of applied and try to see labs where we can work. So Penn State gave me that opportunity to work on a manufacturing lab and OR problem, so I took that.
Okay. I have interviewed Inform's presidents, Radhika Kulkarni and Ramakrishnan. They are Indians who came to the US for higher studies, like you, and they both found their loved ones in grad school. I wonder, did the same happen to you?
So Krishnan and Radhika are both very dear friends of mine, and you're absolutely right. I found the love of my life in graduate school as well. So my husband was already at Penn State when I joined, and I promise I did not know about him at that time. You know, I met him at Penn State. He was a couple of years senior to me, and so fortunately, you know, move from the Delaware was destined for me to find the love of my life.
So I see a trend there. Yeah. What did you study during your master's? You mentioned manufacturing, you know, or so tell me about it.
Yes. So for my master's, I worked on manufacturing and, you know, robotics and automation, something that you hear all about right now. So I had a chance on working on a NSF-funded grant, and we were trying to build an automated computer-controlled manufacturing environment. And I had the opportunity not just to directly work with the machines and how to coordinate with the machines, but also at a higher level, kind of write the scheduling algorithms that help coordinate between the machines and actually in an actual environment itself. So we could actually give command codes and the robot would take a piece of aluminum and take it to a lathe machine, and the lathe would operate, and then you would remove it and take it to a milling machine. So you know, that kind of opportunity that gave you the hands-on ability to actually operate on a true system, talk to machines, but also from a higher level, you know, build the scheduling, which at that time I leveraged simulations a lot that helped us figure out how do you leverage simulation tools to try and test out alternatives in real time to create a better throughput through the system. So it was an amazing project because I hadn't used C, C++ that much till that time. So got really into leveraging not just computing and being able to do sort of programming at a machine level, but also to kind of get above at a supervisory control level to detect when to, you know, deadlocks happen and how do you maintain a throughput in a completely automated fashion. So that led to my PhD, which was a little bit more extension of that.
Yeah, so it's a very interdisciplinary work. According to what you just said, you address several disciplines of engineering and trying to solve a complex problem. And I mean, I suppose you should have learned really a lot from that experience. And I want to hear now about your PhD work.
Yes. So again, just you like said, interdisciplinary stuff, I used to keep finding adjacent fields that, you know, I wanted to try new things off. So for my PhD, again, I was working on manufacturing scheduling problems itself, but I was now trying to abstract it more at a level of using, you know, the mathematical modeling and through OR, not simulation, through OR techniques. And again, you saw that physical abstraction where I was working with the machines and the robots and talking to it. In my PhD, my emphasis was, okay, how do I leverage statistics and economics, and I actually model the problem as an auction to be able to distribute the problem amongst a, you know, series of computers that can simultaneously try to solve a problem that would have required a parallel computer. So the aspect that, you know, in my next PhD that I could stretch was, you know, go more towards mathematical modeling, go more towards actually leveraging computer-to-computer conversations. So basically use a LAN to solve and simulate a behavior of what we can now try to get out of parallel computers. So again, then, you know, just an adjusted field, which I think became a little far bigger in, you know, in the years after that.
Yeah, very interesting. You started working at BNSF Railway before completing your PhD, right?
Yes, that's correct. So I mentioned my husband was a couple of years senior to me, and we got married in while I was still working on my master's. So I was in my middle of my PhD when he found a job and moved to Dallas. So I stayed there for 1 year beyond him, but you know, he was 2 years senior to me. So the last year of my PhD, once I had finished most of my computational experiments and I was writing up a series of papers, I came join BNSF, who, you know, it was just fortuitous that I found that job. And it was too hard to refuse, so I continued my PhD while working at BNSF.
And when did you decide to become a practitioner instead of a scholar? Because I suppose that was the original plan, right?
I know, that's extremely interesting. So I had come abroad to go to my master's and PhD and become an academic at some time. You know, the fact that BNSF offered me a job and I thought that it doesn't hurt for me to move, take the, and be closer to my husband. I can finish off my PhD and get exposed to working as a practitioner and then decide to find my true academic job. Well, I loved what I did in BNSF. And, you know, that just opened my horizons to what a practitioner's life is. And I enjoyed it. I was good at it. So, I, you know, here 20 years later, I'm still a practitioner.
Yeah. And tell me about your first years at BNSF.
So my first few years, again, you know, this was great because, you know, the railroad is a complex network problem. And when I joined BNSF, you know, you could just turn your head in any direction and you would find one more classical OR problem. An OR problem that are not easy to solve. I mean, whether it is assigning crews to trains, trains are not an asset in itself. You actually collect a group of cars to make the trains. So how do you block and make trains so you can serve your customers? How do you assign locomotives? So there was just challenges to solve any direction you looked at. So one of my first projects that was assigned to me was about how, you know, a car is routed from its origin to destination. And it was an enumeration algorithm that was run on a mainframe and would run out of memory most of the time and never find an optimal path. So I actually brought in, you know, KPath and Dijkstra's method to be able to solve that problem out there. So that was my initial years. And that's what got me hooked into becoming a practitioner out there.
And in what language that enumerative approach was coded?
So it was written in COBOL.
Wow.
So, you know, and a lot of edge cases built in. So, you know, that's where my wonderful journey of practitioners began, because it took me literally an afternoon to design an algorithm once I heard how it had been implemented. But it took us a year and a half of a team of about roughly 40 people to truly implement it and, you know, re-architect it in the mainframe. Because one, it was written with so many edge cases and was written in COBOL. So it was very important to be able to translate what we had built in C and C++ and be able to actually understand all the technical issues the development team was bringing up as a challenge. So knowing the language truly helped me understand and for every edge case create a solution. So, you know, it was, like I said, half a day to build the initial version to tell them how many arcs you can save in compute time if you don't do it. But, you know, at least a year of technical, rigorous design work before that algorithm was actually implemented back.
So you were on your way to become a leader then?
Yes. So again, you know, it was a natural path. At that time, I was leading the project technical team, not the overall, because it was such a big project. And I was still a year from my PhD and still finishing off my PhD, honestly. So, but a year later is when I was given the team that worked on OR and analytics, and I became a leader of that team.
Yeah. So do you think that leadership is something that one can acquire and develop over the years with training, for example, or is it more like a natural talent?
I don't think it's a natural talent. I think leadership is something that you make a deliberate effort, you're mindful, and you develop. Each one of us has the capability to become a leader. It's us just trying to practice that muscle and being aware about it and using it. So I don't think I was a natural leader. I think I observed folks around. I observed what they did right and made me give the best. And that's what I tried to emulate. Just like, you know, the books, there's so much content out there that helps you become a best version of who you are. So I think all of us make mistakes. And so for me, the leadership has been a journey and I still continue to evolve. And the idea is, how do I really not just bring the best out of myself, but bring the best out of my whole team out there so that it doesn't feel like work and we're truly enjoying and working towards a bigger goal.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting for you to say that, because sometimes a person that is really introverted might think that, nah, I cannot occupy that role. That's for extroverted people or for people that has, you know, a gift for that particular activity. But sometimes you can, as you said, practice and with experience develop that ability over the years. Yeah.
Yes.
You worked on various projects over the next years, and eventually you moved from the technology team to the operational team, even managing the locomotive teams, right?
That's correct. That's correct. So, you know, when I took over the analytics team, one of my biggest emphasis at that time was how do we frame the problems to actually solve the real problem? So there is no analytics problem, there is no data science problem, there is no OR problem. We are trying to solve a business problem, at least as a practitioner. We are out there to make money for the company or make things better for the company. So I think, you know, whether it was in the subsequent years after the cars, we focused on how we planned crews, how we designed trains, how do we design, you know, how often the trains run. People who were making those decisions were always the most important part of framing that problem, because you needed to wear those shoes to understand what do we really need to solve, and something that as technical leaders we kind of get caught a lot on which model to use becomes a secondary step. I mean, you need to have a lot of tools in your toolbox, but truly it's never an LP problem, never a quadratic or NLP problem, because that's not what the business cares about. So the end user cares about the answer makes sense to them. So how do we enable and empower a human in the loop is an important part. And that kind of led to my journey on wanting to actually lead the locomotive teams too. Learning the business is very essential for you to be successful and your teams to be successful as well. And so I wanted to model that way. I mean, I had been managing analytics team for almost 7-8 years by that time. And I felt I had the bandwidth to continue to manage them and manage some operating teams and learn the business. So fortunately, again, I had leaders that believed in me, and they said, as long as I can do both, they gave me that chance. So I had a chance to learn how to manage around the clock, you know, team that assigns locomotives. And if the locomotives are not there, guess what? The train shut down. So I got a chance to manage one region, then I managed two regions of the three regions. And I think that was one of the most wonderful experiences, because it made me learn on relying a lot more on my leadership skills, because I was not the domain expert when I went there. So I had to learn to rely on my team, listen to them, because they knew far more than the domain, about the domain and about how locomotives work than I did. So my listening skills, my ability to question and ask them kind of improved in that process. And my belief in, you know, I do not need to just be a technical leader where I know the domain, also kind of blossomed in that environment. So again, a wonderful experience that I would encourage any technical leader to take.
Yeah, you have just answered my next question. I was going to ask how to craft an OR solution that's workable in practice. But I think I just got the answer, so I'm happy with that. Yeah, so after winning the Informs Award for the best advanced analytics team in 2019, you left BNSF and joined Otis. Tell me more about this transition.
So Neil Green, who's my current boss, he met me at Informs when we were being awarded the Informs Award, and I was also the chair of Edelman award at that time. So he thought that what I had done at BNSF was something he would like me to set up at Otis. So he brought me on to Otis a few years ago, and I'm glad I joined and made that transition, because you know, I had brought BNSF from a point where we were a handful of team members that were working on some small problems here and there, to the point over the course of 20 years, we were pretty much penetrated in every area of the business, on how cars were managed, how crews were managed, how locomotives were managed, how we inspected our tracks. So, you know, we were not just limited to classical OR problems. We were doing data science, machine learning, video analytics. So, you know, coming to Otis gave me that chance to kind of start up and set up an environment from scratch for a global company, which has also, again, been an immensely knowledgeable experience for me, because, you know, global company with present in over 100 plus countries has its own set of complexities that you need to design for. So again, a wonderful experience that I would not, you know, have liked to miss. So glad I'm here.
Right. Can you mention some of the OR applications that one can find at Otis?
So, you know, at Otis, I'm both a data officer and a data analytics officer. So, you know, I will mention a couple of our analytics, but I will also talk a little bit about the importance of focusing on the data ecosystem. So, you know, we talk a lot about data science, but we forget that science comes after the data, and having that ecosystem and access to information that people can trust is equally important for us in success in long run. So one of the first things I did at Otis was to start building a modern data ecosystem for them that allows us access to information, whether our internal customers or our external customers, in a real-time manner, so that we can build these analytic solutions I talked about. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. So Otis has a big connected products initiative called as Otis One. And the idea is that, you know, we have over 2 million units, elevators that we maintain. And each of this elevator, just like your smartphone or any digital products, generates a ton of data internally that we can tap into. So Otis One is our connected product. It ensures we have access to, you know, real-time diagnostic, controller information, service information on a unit that we can use to actually give a better customer experience or uptime on the product. So our emphasis is, how do we leverage all of that data that's being generated to anticipate our maintenance needs? To be able to, as the mechanic visits the unit, kind of proactively modify what should they focus on and what can they defer to the next time, so that over the course of time, our availability on products is, you know, improved over the time. It's, you know, also helps our mechanics, because we have various kinds of controllers. So it might not be that a mechanic is an expert in on all kinds of controllers. So you can imagine its empowerment of our mechanics itself, because we can do real-time diagnostics, because we can understand what the controller is saying and kind of translate it for a mechanic that's trying to fix an elevator of what are the things they need to focus on. So that's one of our connected products. So, you know, there is a whole team that's been focused around Otis One. And I have one of my teams that's focused on what insights do we deliver for managing the condition of the unit part of Otis One. So I have a team that actually manages those insights and Lux leverages, you know, service information, controller information. But more than that, when you're generating multiple gigs of data every day, so you can imagine to build data science models that leverage weeks, months, years of data on that unit to be able to deliver an insight is as much, you know, complexity on the data side as on the data science side. So when I joined Otis, I made sure we constructed a data science platform itself so that we can give the power that the data scientists needed to be able to build those algorithms and insights. So that's one of our connected products. There's another product which, you know, my team created. It's called this Compass Infinity, and that's our smart elevator. So just like you are getting used to smart, you know, ovens and smart refrigerators, we are building our smart elevators. And the idea is that, you know, the customer traffic patterns change over the course of time, you know, pandemic being a classical example. And at the heart of an elevator, or let me say the brain of the elevator, we call it a dispatcher or a supervisory control that actually tells in these big buildings where you go, where there are multiple cars, which car gets assigned to what demand. And so my team has built sort of analytics on the edge that anonymize. We do not know who's pressed the button, but we understand the call buttons itself. And so we understand the demand pattern, and we can adjust the dispatching parameters to be able to give the best dispatcher performance. So we have built in multiple AI ML capabilities that can run on the edge to make that elevator become smarter over the course of time. So it understands traffic patterns, it parks based on energy efficiency, it parks based on how you need to use it. So overall passenger experience is improved.
Wow. I mean, there are very nice and relevant applications. You mentioned not only optimization, but AI and statistics, and it is data-driven in its best too. So I was very pleased to hear that. And I wonder, what do you think of black box approaches in analytics?
I'm not a big fan of black box approaches in analytics. I believe, you know, I know we are aiming to clear the Turing test at one time, but I believe the human mind is a very complex mind. It's easier for us to empower and enable people than to create a complete automated environment and cut them out of the loop. So, you know, till we reach that stage, that's what my hope is. So, you know, you mentioned a phrase, data-driven. So that's exactly my mantra for my team. I want to build a data-driven Otis. I want to make sure whether it is complex AI, ML-based algorithms, OR-based algorithms, or simple, you know, descriptive analytics. I want every employee within Otis to have access to information they need to do their job the best they can. So if that means that you are a supervisor managing multiple mechanics, I want to be able to let you see how your mechanics perform. Do they need coaching in certain areas? How much did they travel last time? Is there an opportunity for you to think about reducing your unproductive travel time? If you are, you know, leader of a branch, how are your mechanics and salespeople doing? Are there some projects that require your attention? Have you ordered materials on time? And not all of them are, you know, nice, cool AI ML algorithms, which is fine for me. I think my purpose is, and my team's goal is, to actually enable the human mind to focus on an actionable insight. So don't want to clutter your desktop or your mobile phone with clutter of information, but rather give you targeted information, a handful of things that you need to focus on based on your role. So, you know, You mentioned a couple of AI ML algorithms, so I gave you a couple of cool examples around it. But you know, I can actually think of a lot of other descriptive analytics work that my team has done, which I find equally proud of, even though all they've done is aggregated a lot of information. But if you talk to the end users, for them, it's the best thing since sliced bread. So to me, that is equally exciting as the smart elevator product my team designed.
Yeah, I can imagine. It requires a tremendous amount of effort to put that together. There are so many challenges. And I assume you have to manage international teams at some point.
Absolutely.
Because it's a huge company. And when you're dealing with, you know, people from different countries, there might be, you know, different cultural backgrounds and things like that. And from your experience, what lessons you learn from this, and what type of advice can you give to people that are in a similar situation?
So you made an excellent point out there. I mean, we have people from different countries. I think one of the things, like, remember the bouquet of beautiful flowers. I feel that analogy to people as well. There are times we don't understand the customs, you know, especially when I remember talking to the Japan team at one time and learned how to articulate and address them. You know, how do you refer to people and how do you ask, you know, what is the decorum of questioning a person in meeting versus not questioning? I think there is opportunity for all of us to learn that and be a little bit more mindful of it. I wouldn't say I did all the things right. I made some mistakes and learned from it too. But having said that, I think it's the openness to be able to have that conversation and a meaningful connection, and then kind of bringing us all together as a team to solve a problem. So, you know, I think I never thought my PhD limited me from AIML and sticking to cool things. So I feel in the last few years, I've learned as much about delivering technology at scale as much as I did in my PhD learning about some of these tools and techniques. So, you know, how do we engage the business users? There's science behind it. I mean, so the whole process of engaging an end user, there is, I'm not sure you heard about it, but I think if your students haven't, they should be thinking about, but, you know, agile and DevOps process. How do you deliver technology in increments? How do you interview and bring your people, your end stakeholders, part of the interviews? You design, you know, technology with wireframes first and then embed it. So you limit your failures, point of failures, because you're bite-sizing it. So makes sense from, you know, analytics perspective, but that's how we are now delivering technology. And how do you make sure your team comes to that kind of learning as well? Again, as I told you, making it data-driven, Otis. So one of the things I had to actually make sure is my team also focuses on the food being appealing to consume too. So, you know, training them on UI UX design, making sure we're just not bringing in information for the sake of bringing in. And my first question used to be, what is the action they're going to take once they know about it? Mm-hmm. Kind of started driving them towards, you know, using one graph versus another graph to ensure that it clearly pops out that these metrics are in green, these are in red, these are in yellow. You need to focus your attention on it. Aha, it's time for you to order your materials. It's time for you to, you know, think about billing your customers. Mm-hmm. So I think these are sort of the way we deliver technology. So, you know, you talked about in the past what's fun to learn. So in Otis, I've got a chance to be exposed to not just global teams and be able to coordinate them to deliver things, but also have a chance to honestly start from grounds up, you know, that kind of team that focuses on delivering analytics at scale.
Wow, super impressive. I see that you not only care about just giving orders or instructions, you clearly care about making the members of your team evolve. I mean, like almost like as a mentor, literally. and that's crucial, I believe, because as you said, like you want your team to be improving over time, and you have, of course, to have that connection, that bond. But also when you feel that they are developing other skills because you are somewhat guiding them, and when you see the result, it should be really rewarding, I believe, right? So when it comes to Informs, what is your involvement in bringing together practitioners and academics?
So this is again a topic that's very close to my heart. So I am a person who thought will be an academic and turned into a practitioner. And a lot of skills that we needed as practitioners kind of learned during my work itself. And analytics has changed a lot in the last 25 years. If you can think about, you know, we've had discussions around what is data science, what is OR, what is ML, but honestly, as a practitioner, even though those clear definitions might not exist, we do not care, because our goal is to truly how to solve the problem, how do we frame the problem and create an impact in the organization. So really what is used as that solution or that tool to help you out is, you know, not that important. So wanted to make sure that, you know, future students that are coming out of these universities kind of are exposed to these thought processes and these tools part of their training itself. And you could see that, you know, how masters in data analytics or data science programs have developed to include Capstone and include the art of understanding how to ask questions. These are skills I feel that are equally important as learning and taking a class on linear programming and quadratic programming and nonlinear programming. Because if you need to solve problems, a lot of these problems you will solve as a team. And these skills are equally important as your ability to technically model that solution.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I was always engaged, you know, in Informs effort about bringing, you know, the design of the Masters in Analytics program. We had created at an Informs level groups, so I was part of that. I led a couple of industry practitioner teams, part of it, to give feedback to the academic in, you know, community on what's needed, organized panels, part of it. The other way I've done it is, you know, not a luxury that I got part of my PhD, but I wanted to make sure so many students solve OR problems for their PhD, but they don't have a real world application. So while I was at BNSF, it was very important for me to actually ensure that my future talent pool not just gets the rigor of learning OR techniques, but also has the ability to think about the computing needs or how to frame a real problem itself while they're doing. So I always had 3 to 5 PhDs that we used to sponsor part of BNSF for several years. And a lot of them became part of my future talent pool, part of BNSF itself, to help us out. And I continue that, you know, in Otis as well. You know, I bring in now with an eye on diverse talent. So I have a person in my team. She actually started as an intern working for us. Actually, two of them, they both started as interns before they joined Otis in my team. One working on the smart elevators, one working on the condition side.
Yeah, that's important. And I think this type of initiative should be carried out in different countries. Even in Brazil, we have, you know, this dialogue between academia and industry should be more intense. And, you know, panels like the ones you mentioned should be organized in our local conferences. So this, you know, communication between both ends can be done in a more efficient way. You are an executive sponsor of the Women in Technology Employee Resource Group. Can Can you talk more about this initiative?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, I talked a little bit about my childhood. You know, during my formative years, my schooling, my parents, they never exposed to me that there is a difference between being a girl or a boy in what you can do. Unfortunately, a lot of women are not exposed to that environment. And I feel in their formative years, it's almost like a sapling that does not get enough water and sunlight to be able to become the best plant or tree they're supposed to be in their formative years. So, you know, I was always aware about that fact and always also aware about the fact that, you know, I recognize it's an issue, but I wanted to pay it forward to help some of the women that had to go through it, to help them get the confidence. So, you know, when I started the internship programs with university, it was with that eye in the mind to give some women talent that much needed, you know, experience and confidence that they need to have in their own skills. So they start competing at an equal level and footing when they are interviewed for the position itself. And fortunately for me, you know, Otis is a company that is extremely focused around diversity, equity, and inclusion. In fact, we were recognized in Newsweek just a week earlier about our initiatives, and I was tapped in to lead and become one of the co-chairs, executive co-chairs for Women in Technology. And I have to tell you, it's honestly an honor, and it's very close to my heart because I feel, you know, people choose religion, people choose, you know, sometimes, but I was born in as a woman. I mean, that was the first identity I knew. So I do recognize there's a huge gender parity issue. And in whatever way possible, I want to increase the outreach so that even if I influence one or two women, you know, or one or two girls' life to consider STEM as an opportunity to, you know, help them get into big companies with STEM background. While they are part of Otis, how do I help them groom and mentor them to their back, you know, the best level and set up a whole infrastructure for mentoring itself and outreach. And then, you know, I think there is not enough people that look like you for the women. So how do you create those examples and help become a sponsor for those women, so that they do get access to the guidance, the insight, and their name is referenced? Because a lot of times, like I mentioned, these women are not given the courage and self-confidence in formative years. So how do you make them understand that it is possible and they need to just look around and ask for that help? So again, very near dear to my heart, and that's something that I'm fortunate. Again, my husband, my kids are very well, you know, they've been very supportive in that environment for me. So I kind of tell them it is possible to have both work and life. And how do you engage your wider, you know, family to help you in that journey out when they are not recognizing that you might be spending three times more time than what your husband is spending at home? So, you know, again, important factors, but that's the state of our society at this point of time. So women do not get that luxury of being able to choose. And so they need to be aware that it is possible. And how do they talk and have access to peers to discuss those issues that would be discussed outside?
Mm-hmm. You once mentioned that the family is sort of a village, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Thank you for reminding me. It really does take a village to, you know, get somewhere. So for me, you know, my parents were there before I met my husband, and my husband and my kids are equally responsible for my success, because there have been times, I will tell you, that when I want to say this is not the right time, or I will not believe in my own capabilities despite where I am, And my husband and my kids are the ones that will keep reminding me, no, it's possible and you can go there. So again, all of us need our own village and cheerleaders to help us be the best person.
Yeah, I like the cheerleaders reference. still in this context, was there any event in your life that someone tried to discourage you from following a certain path because of your gender?
Yes, I did. So I had a wonderful childhood, wonderful schooling. I, you know, was the gold medalist in my school and I ended up in a college based on merit. And I remember the first few days, there was a student that came to me and, you know, he was a few years senior to me and he said, why am I joining the college? And, you know, honestly, the naive me couldn't even understand what is he saying. And then he said, well, you're a girl. You're going to get married and you're wasting a seed that a man can take and he's going to have a career. I can't tell you. I mean, I guess I was shocked. I had never been exposed to gender inequality and what, you know, what women can do and cannot do, and did not even know how to respond to the person. And it really did have, you know, an impact on me for I would say a few weeks and months itself. But, you know, I got past it. I felt that was his frame of reference. That's him. And what he thinks women are supposed to do, he's not supposed to dictate my life. Again, those formative years and confidence helped. And I didn't think it was necessary for somebody else to dictate what I can do and cannot do. So I think I could get past it. Again, not, you know, I've heard this story from a lot of successful women out there. So I don't think this is unique to me. Mm-hmm. But having said that, you know, I did get married according to that guy, but here I am and I have got a successful career and I didn't have to choose one or the other. So, you know, I could get past it. So.
Yeah, I wish I could see where this guy is now. So... Yeah, so he can swallow his words until the last letter. Pooja, you have recently experienced a very unfortunate event regarding your house. What lessons did you learn and are still learning from this experience?
Yeah, so, you know, Anand, you're referring to my house was struck by lightning about 6 months ago, and we were out on vacation and it got burned down. Fortunately, all of us are safe. We are sound and healthy. I think the lesson to learn on that side were a couple of things. I think since coming back, that incident, as hard as it was for me and my family, we got past that acceptance and desire to move forward because, you know, you don't have an option. It's happened. You got to deal with it and you got to move on. We've lost some prized things, but we are all there with each other. That's what matters. But I've had to deal with, you know, the insurance companies. I've had to deal with the HOAs and approvals. And each one of them, you know, come with their own set of challenges. So one thing that I remind myself after that experience, especially when dealing with companies, is how we forget the focus on customer and empathy in the process, and it dehumanizes people in the process, which is not good. So, you know, giving examples of insurance companies, I understand you're dealing with people that are going through it. Being mindful of what people are going through, you could make your processes a lot more to support people who are your faithful customers for decades to help them out. So, you know, something that I was always mindful of, to keep the customer as a focal point when you're delivering technology, I think this has been even a more reinforcing experience for me to remind myself that extremely important to not forget the person in the loop. It's very easy for people to craft, you know, policies and hide behind it, but not a right thing for the business in long run. And you know, it can, if you start thinking from human perspective, I think we can get processes that work for the company, yet make sure you create customers or people for lifetime, because you truly did work with them and not hide behind the policies itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it has been a tough time for you and to deal with the insurance company. How do you handle emotionally? Sometimes it can be hard to take your mind away from your job or from these type of situations. What do you do when you are in a very, you know, dealing with high stakes and things mm-hmm. that are really complicated, and you can't help but keep on thinking about that when even you go to your house? You know, regarding all of this, how do you, you know, deal with all these things?
So again, I was at a state in my life, my kids, you know, one of my kids is already in college, the other was going into college. So honestly, me and my husband, we were in a groove, had worked out work-life balance, knew how to do, but things like this happen. So if I was to tell you, were there not stressful times and stages? Absolutely. You know, to the point where I would take, there were times where I would tell my team with transparency, I said, a lot going on. I need to just step back and be mindful of that fact. I need to get this over the hump. So again, fortunate to have good peers, good leader, good team that kind of, when needed, gave me those few hours that I needed to deal with the issue itself. Not only that, I was mindful of the fact that this has an impact on not just me, but my kids, my husband, and all of us. Because, you know, after a family member, house is the next level of constants you need in your life. But again, getting past it and focusing on the future and saying, okay, now what will we build was something that all four of us decided we are going to focus on. So that as you are mindful of the ups and downs we are going through, but again, keep reminding ourselves towards that future we are trying to get. So we'll get through it. Mm-hmm. It's a process. And hopefully next time we talk this time, I might be in my new home at that time.
Yeah, so you rely a lot of the stability of your family and in being surrounded by great people. That actually makes a difference. But on a daily basis, what do you do to, you know, get distracted? I know you like to cook.
Yes, I'd like to cook. So I am a foodie, okay? So I love to travel and I love to experience food in different countries and, you know, places, and I love to recreate them at home too. So you're absolutely right. Cooking is one of the ways I de-stress. I also love to do yoga. I used to do running quite a bit, but with the treadmill gone with the house, I haven't still bought a new treadmill. So running is a little out of focus just now, but yoga and cooking, they still are part of my life. And they give me the joy. So, you know, the year before the pandemic happened, I had gone to 4 countries in one single year. So I'm hoping a year, maybe not in 23, but in 24, I go to 5 in a single year with my family. So that's my goal at that time.
Yeah, and I hope you include Brazil in the...
Absolutely, I'd love that.
Food here is amazing in Brazil. So in if you go to different states, you'll find a different experience. So I strongly recommend you to consider including Brazil in your route.
I'd love that. So in that year that I mentioned in 2019, I had gone to Peru and we were considering going to see the rainforest in Brazil too, but the vacation had to be boxed in. So
yeah. And I love the Peruvian cuisine, by the way. I've been there in 2018. And I just fell in love. I liked it very much. So, Pooja, I read in one of your recent interviews that you have several leadership books on your nightstand. Have you considered writing your own book on the topic, maybe with an emphasis on OR and analytics? I think it would be a great contribution.
Oh, that's so nice of you. You know, this is the same comment my son has made with several times and told me about it. So absolutely, I consider doing that. Haven't considered it at the moment. I'm gonna start small, perhaps do some blogs and podcasts before I enter into the world of book, but someday.
Yeah, you have my entire support. If you want to discuss, you know, brainstorming, I'll be super happy to collaborate, to help. I think this will be extremely important for the community, for the women, and, you know, for the younger generation. You cannot find a lot of material discussing the leadership aspect specifically related to OR, optimization, analytics, how to craft a solution that would work in practice. You have plenty of experience, industrial experience, and also, you know, bridging that gap between academia and industry and practitioners and scholars. It's something that puts you in a unique position. So I think you should seriously consider doing that. And I know it's a hard endeavor in a way, but it can be really good and can impact the life of so many people.
Well, you're too kind, and I know a person who does podcasts really, really well, who's sitting right there. So I'll take up your offer, and perhaps we can do a joint podcast someday.
Who knows? Yeah, why not? Yeah. So, Pooja, I had a wonderful time chatting with you. It was a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for sharing. Many experiences, and it has been inspiring talking to you. I can't thank you enough.
Same here. It has been a pleasure speaking with you, Anand. You know, when you initially approached me, I felt, okay, an hour and a half talking is going to be really hard, but I do not know where the time passed away. So, you know, that speaks volume to the kind of conversation and engagement we could have. And, you know, thank you. I just want to leave, you know, I told you women are extremely, you know, women in technology is especially very special and near and dear to my heart. But in general, you know, just some parting advice to some students you might have over there is to say that in the world that we live in, you know, things are moving really fast. Skills needed are moving really fast. Any plan you create is useless by the time it's executed, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't be planning. So continue to learn and disrupt yourself. You know, when I started my career, I never thought where I'm going to end up, but I continued to learn and disrupt myself. I always had, like you said, plenty of leadership books, podcasts, you know, open, you know, focus on the customer. And it's not just about tools and technologies. It's about people. We are trying to create a difference in people's lives. Those tools are just a tool, you know, a screwdriver in a toolbox we took out to solve. And there might be a different screwdriver each time or a different hammer each time. But as long as you can focus on the customer, you can focus on that journey of creating the difference and evolve with it, I think you're going to be successful in the long run.
All right. I would just like to thank Informs President Radhika Kulkarni that introduced us. And she insisted that I would have so much fun talking to you. And she was right. And you're a great person, Pooja, and I hope you stay very active for so many years and keep on mentoring, inspiring, and helping people from OR and even from society in general, especially the women that are interested in, you know, going to STEM and these topics. So once again, thank you so much. It was lovely.
Thank you, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, so keep in mind to include Brazil in your route, and I hope to meet you in person soon. Okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, Goodbye. Ciao.
Bye. Ciao.